Well, immigration rules, as you've been hearing, are going to be tightened from midday today, ending visa-free entry to refugees from 20 other European countries, but not from Ukraine. Why? What will be achieved? Is the move legal? Will it meaningfully reduce refugee numbers? Daniel McConnell, political editor of The Examiner, has hopefully some details for us. Daniel, what changes are coming and why does the government see the need for them?
Yeah, so this was a move that sort of was first tabled last Thursday. There was a meeting of the Cabinet Subcommittee to deal with, at that stage, was essentially the country's accommodation for refugees being at capacity, as we all remember, and there was talk of scaling up Gormanston at that stage. And this proposal was essentially tabled by Simon Coveney and Helen McEntee, and ultimately, and as the Taoiseach told his parliamentary party last week, that there essentially was a large number, or has been a large number of people seeking kind of refuge in Ireland who have not been from Ukraine, and those numbers have gone up exponentially over the last number of months. And there's a real concern as to why that this has happened. So there was an incorporeal cabinet meeting yesterday. This is one where they don't meet in person. They essentially agree this on the nod, either by telephone or by some other mechanism. And ultimately, the proposal was signed off on. And what it means is essentially that, you know, refugees coming into Ireland from 20 safe European countries will now have to apply for a visa. They can still come here, but only now if they have a visa. And ultimately, the government are saying they're doing this with regret, but it's clearly that they feel the system is being overwhelmed. And more sinister, the kind of guidance we were getting last night is that there essentially, you know, there were warnings of forged documents showing up. There were alarming patterns of people who have essentially been approved for international protection in other countries now coming here. So there was essentially a kind of a sense that Ireland was a bit of a soft touch. And ultimately, what they're trying to do is make sure that we can honour our obligations to our Ukrainian friends who are coming here. But also we need to kind of obviously tighten up the procedures to ensure that the country doesn't find itself overwhelmed with numbers coming in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on that, on those reasons that were presented, was there any evidence offered as to Helen McEntee's claim that the system was being gamed by some refugees?
Yeah, so my understanding is that ministers were essentially given some guidance or some information around the level of forgery that are showing up. But also what I was guided very strongly on last night was the alarming patterns of people, large numbers of people coming in, having kind of been approved in previous and other countries. And essentially, you know, what we were also being told was that, you know, the impact of the UK's introduction of the Rwanda scheme, even though it's not in place yet, it almost had a chilling effect, mm-hmm. and was causing people to redirect towards Ireland. All of these things wrapped in together at a time when our housing stock was already under significant pressure anyway, created this perfect storm where essentially we were running out of room for, and this was essentially the reason why this government has gone to this particular level, or has moved to do this.
There's NGOs who are saying that there's nothing sinister about this kind of travel, that people who have been granted refugee status in one country very often want to visit relatives in another European country, and that is the reason that they come here and seek protected status when they do so. Does the government acknowledge that as a possible genuine reason for travel?
They do, and they were expressing a regret, and this is something that they didn't necessarily want to do, but they did also warn of credible intelligence that they got that, you know, there was a secondary attraction effect at play, that, you know, essentially people were seeing family members or distant family members already here and saying, well, listen, that seems like a good place to go. So you had the snowball effect essentially of people arriving here in large numbers, and ultimately there was a genuine concern that if we were going to honour those commitments to the people of Ukraine, and at a time, as I said, when we're now moving people into temporary tented accommodation, something had to be done. And, you know, ultimately it was about protecting the integrity of the system, particularly as we head into kind of autumn and winter. We could not continue with this sort of unfettered access, and that ultimately was the consideration made.
The numbers that we're talking about are not entirely insignificant, but nor are they particularly large. I mean, it's 760 notifications of someone in receipt of international protection in another state. So if the government was looking to make a meaningful contribution to reducing the pressure on refugee accommodation, this is not it, is it?
No, but I suppose what this is a first step. And what it is, I suppose it comes in the context that they've said that, you know, the number seeking international protection has increased by 300%. So there has, even though in kind of, I suppose, raw numbers, it's relatively small. But in terms of the scale of what we have seen previously, it is a significant increase. But it comes again, I suppose, it's not in isolation. It comes at a time when we've large numbers of Ukrainians coming in. With, you know, 40,000 have come in so mm-hmm. far, and at a time when, as I said already, our own, you know, we have homelessness figures now over 10,000. So it's a sort of wider perfect storm implications for the overall system. I think that has led this decision to be made. But I also think as well, I think there was a genuine fear that if Ireland was to remain out of step with other European countries, that all of a sudden we could see a very, very large number of people starting to arrive here. And, well, and that would not be tenable. That's ultimately what I was guided upon last night.
Okay, well, on that, have we been able to fact check whether this does move us out of step? Because I understood that this was a right that was accorded under an international agreement, one that we are now unilaterally reneging on.
Yeah, so this is ultimately a Council of Europe kind of the system. This, and ultimately we are opting out of it as of now. I suppose what we're looking to try and find out exactly today is just how many others are either have done this or are likely to do this. That information wasn't readily available last night. But ultimately, I suppose what the government is, as I said, trying to do is make sure that we just don't find ourselves with a kind of a Calais type situation. Again, that was one of the warnings given to me last night. We don't end ourselves up where we have large numbers amassing at our borders trying to get in, or arriving here and overwhelming the system, because ultimately we just don't have the capacity to take such large numbers in.
Well, one would wonder whether that is something that is more real than apparent. But let's go back on the first principles of this issue and whether we are reneging on an international agreement or not. Stay with us, Danny, because I'm also joined by Stephen Kerwin, a partner with KOD Lyons Law Firm and an expert in immigration and asylum law. Stephen, can we start with a first principle question here that you might be able to help me out on? Why did we give visa-free travel to refugees from other countries in the first place, and what is being lost by taking it away?
Thanks a million, Philip, and hopefully I can answer that question in a straightforward way. So ultimately, when someone is granted refugee status, either in Ireland or in another country, they generally receive a declaration pursuant to the 1951 Geneva Convention, right? But it doesn't mean that every declaration is treated similarly. What happened at Council of Europe level was there was an agreement between 20 states. Most of them are EU member states, but Norway and Switzerland are also on that list, where visa-free travel could be facilitated. And there's a number of very good and plausible reasons as to why that would be allowed. We look at free movement, I suppose, in the European Union as one ground. But ultimately, the idea was that it was a progressive realization or a movement towards a common asylum system, because at the moment in Europe, we don't have that. So once you receive a declaration in, let's say, for example, Germany or Italy, that's not necessarily recognized in another member state. And there are certain rules and regulations in relation to coordination of those rules, but we do not have a unified system. So this agreement basically facilitates travel between a number of European countries. And it was on that basis that the Council of Europe decided to abolish those visas as a sign of kind of commitment.
And was it mostly to facilitate family reunification?
Well, no, the idea, the stated purpose of the rule was to abolish what we call the entry visa requirement. So basically, we operate a two-tier system in Ireland. If someone wants to come to Ireland, for example, on holidays or for any other reason, there are certain countries where we require them to apply for an entry visa before they present at the borders. And there are other countries where we don't require it. So this was kind of an exception to the normal rule, if you think of it that way.
Presumably, while obviously people do come here on foot of this provision, we were also beneficiaries of it, so to speak, that there were people who had arrived in this country and got refugee status here who would be free to travel to Germany, to the Netherlands, or wherever else where there's perhaps greater reason, greater economic incentive for them to be there.
Absolutely, and that would be a key point that I know certainly myself and a number of my colleagues in the NGO sector would make, that this is a bilateral agreement. And I think, again, without getting into the, I suppose, the specifics of it here, I think it's quite funny how we have a government on one hand, which gives out about, you know, the government of the in the United Kingdom about breaching bilateral agreements and bilateral treaties, and yet we're very willing to do it here in this context.
So you're absolutely clear about that. This is the unilateral suspension or reneging by Ireland of an agreement made not just bilaterally, but multilaterally with 19 other countries.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that would be my. We have instances in the past where there has been derogations. I know the UK, I believe, Jack Horgan-Jones in this morning's piece in the Irish Times notes that I think it was France and the UK had previously derogated. But I mean, ultimately, this is a multilateral treaty, not even a bilateral treaty. You're correct in pointing that out.
Yes, sorry, Jack Horgan-Jones said it was the UK suspended it in 2003 and France in 1986, but I'm not sure if they then reapplied it subsequently.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't be sure of that myself. But ultimately, we're talking about a situation here where, you know, as I say, on one hand, there's a consistency issue, and as I say. You rightly pointed out about the numbers we're talking about here being relatively minor in relation to the number of overall applications. And what I'd like to see is an analysis of, well, within that small cohort of people, how many are in direct provision, for example? How many are using this as a method to reunify without the need to apply for an entry visa? Which at the moment, I can tell you, is extremely difficult for most families to be able to reunite.
Because at the moment, from reading the pieces in the papers today and listening to the message coming from government, the impression that one might form is that these 700 people were here and were either gaming the system or had forged documents. But you're saying that you would be of the impression that the overwhelming reason for them being here would be to try and reunify with family members.
Well, again, in my experience, and certainly I'm certainly not the only person. And as I say, look, is the system open to potential abuse? Every system is open to potential abuse. And you do have to put checks and obviously protections in place there. But if we are genuinely serious about moving towards a common asylum system, well, this is the first step. And I think it's a proportionate piece of legislation or an agreement that's there to facilitate this. And as I said, I don't know whether or not any particular analysis has been done about the actual burden being placed on state resources within that 7%. And as I said, certainly my first-hand experience has been that most are coming here and having to reclaim asylum to be with their family members.
Danny, given the relatively small numbers that we are talking about here, and as we said, you know, might only be a start, but certainly isn't a meaningful contribution to relieving the pressure on refugee accommodation, might it be possible that the real political purpose in this was something that comes at the time that there's increased calls for a cap on the number of refugees arriving here, that what has been generated by this move is a front page headline in the Irish Times, refugee visa rules changed in hardening of policy? Might that have been the intention?
I think so. And ultimately, I think, you know, it allows the government to introduce a cap in form without calling it necessarily a cap. And ultimately, it allows them to do so while honouring the commitments to the people of Ukraine, which it seems to be, if there's a hierarchy or a pecking order, they seem to be placed at the very top. And obviously, you know, there's delicacies here in relation to, because obviously the fact that people coming from Ukraine were given sort of fast-track status in terms of being able to work and getting medical cards and all that kind of stuff, it put them ahead of the queue of people in direct provision. That obviously has been a cause of great concern to a lot of NGOs and other people, you know, civil rights activists and etc. like that. So the government has had to walk a very fine line here about trying to do the right thing while not, I suppose, upsetting other people along the way. But I do think, you know, they are not ignorant to the increased sense of tension. And, you know, we've had warnings about potential civil unrest and kind of, so, you know, the kind of threat to social cohesion around all of this. So they are mindful of that. But I think ultimately, you know, again, what I was being told last night, this is, you know, in the first instance, is primarily about the capacity of the state to address the accommodation issue for those coming in. And we're obviously we're in a very difficult space at the moment. And this is a step to try and address, to try and stem the flow of people coming here who are not from Ukraine. As a first instance, we may see a further tightening down the line. But ultimately, this is what the government is committed to. It's for a year. My information is that, yes, France and England have, and the UK, sorry, have previously done this. My understanding is that they're still out. They haven't yet readopted because they're not listed among the 20 countries where this visa kind of waiver applied. So my understanding is that they're still out of the fold at the moment.
Daniel McConnell of The Examiner and Stephen Kerwin with KOD Lyons Law Firm, thank you both very much.